troops arrived.
An original handwritten by Erasmus himself, not by a secretary, but there is a signature. Erasmus Rotterdamensis manu propria. Written with his own hand, yeah.
So here we are going up the tower. The destruction of Leuven's university library was hotly discussed in the late summer of World War I, when German troops shelled Reims Cathedral in France and destroyed the medieval Draper's Hall in Ypres. Germany's reputation as the leader of European science and culture was in ruins.
Ici finit la culture allemande.
Yeah. This was a kind of inscription, and it appeared on the university hall after the war, of course, when the Germans had left the town. And since the destruction of the library, Germany was labeled not as the Kultur, as a cultured nation, but as a nation of barbarians, of savages, of the Huns.
The Bosch.
Did German leaders order their troops to destroy Leuven's university library? This question would be debated for years.
Was it collateral damage? Have they set fire to the town and also to the library? Or was it a wanton destruction, a deliberate act of cultural vandalism? So up to now, I'm convinced that it was a deliberate act of vandalism, but we don't have a real proof in documents. There is no, what they called in the Second World War, there is no Führerbefehl to find in the archives. So we have only a kind of moral conviction, and we have only a kind of anecdotal evidence, but not the evidence of a written document with the order set fire to the library, because it's the library of the Pfaffenuniversität. There was a strong Protestant and anti-Roman Catholic feeling amongst the troops, the German troops, which came from the northern provinces, which came from the northern part of Germany, the Protestant part of. It's a very difficult question.
C'est le grand-père de papa qui a été pris par les soldats en otage.
For Marie-Thérèse Delcombe, sitting at a crowded café in tourist-packed Leuven, the events of 100 years ago are more than academic.
Alors, il a été devant l'hôpital Saint-Pierre, il a dû faire sa tombe.
She shows me a photo of her great-grandfather digging his own grave, armed German soldiers standing at his side.
It's horrible. It's a horror, the war. In the First World, there was 15 million people dead in all the world. And that, I hope, is an example to them, but the war continues, in the world.
Will this week's commemoration in Leuven and Belgium's other martyr cities help foster a culture of peace? Marie-Thérèse isn't so sure.
Oui, to respect the people who died and all the things, but it's very touristic. I don't know, and young people don't know about it. It's only the old people remember.
Thank you. Read more about the Sack of Louvain at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For $5 or more, you'll be helping to make this podcast happen. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor, a listener-supported podcast. I'm David Kattenberg. It's something human beings take for granted. The world is a very human place, covered by concrete, tall buildings, cars racing this way and that, food from all corners of the planet. Some green space for us humans. Earth's human age has a name, the Anthropocene. Dutch chemist Paul Crutzen coined it 20 years ago. The Anthropocene, Crutzen said, should be declared a new epoch in Earth history, terminating the one we've been in for the past 12,000 years, the Holocene. Sometime this summer, a panel of scientists will move Crutzen's idea up a notch with a proposal of their own on how Earth's human age should be defined geologically. John McNeil is an advisory member on that panel. McNeil was a colleague of Paul Crutzen's and is associated with the idea that the Anthropocene began in the mid-20th century at the start of something called the Great Acceleration, when the scale, scope, and pace of humanity's impact on planet Earth started to skyrocket. John McNeil is a professor of environmental history at Georgetown University in the U.S. That's where I reached him. When did you first hear about or learn about or discover this concept of the Anthropocene? Paul Crutzen coined the term in the year 2000, and Paul Crutzen and Eugene Sturmer. When did you first become aware of the Anthropocene concept?
I first became aware of the Anthropocene term probably a few years after 2000, because I was interacting with Earth scientists on a fairly regular basis. The concept that the globe's environment had undergone radical changes as a result of human activity, that concept I was familiar with long before the term Anthropocene came in over the transom, so to speak. It was no later than about 1990, I would say, that it became clear to me and some other environmental historians too that the last century, maybe the last two centuries, were bizarre, anomalous in the scale, scope, and pace of environmental change. But crystallizing that, as Crutzen did, with a single term, the Anthropocene, that neither I nor anybody else had done until Paul Crutzen did it in 2000.
And am I correct that you sort of coined the term the Great Acceleration, that you this term was proposed by yourself at the Dahlem workshop in Berlin in June 2005. Can you own up to this?
Yes, I can. At least that's the way I remember it and the way that Will Steffen remembers it. So the Dahlem workshop was a sort of integrated, interdisciplinary gathering devoted to the past, present, and possible futures of global scale environmental change. That's where I first met Paul Crutzen. And in one of the subgroups of the workshop that Will Steffen and I were involved, trying to come to grips with the 20th century, we recognized that the middle of the 20th century seemed to be a point of inflection with respect to so many different variables that are involved in global scale environmental change, that it seemed to deserve its own term. And because I had recently read for the first time Karl Polanyi's 1944 work called The Great Transformation, I thought that the great acceleration would be a good term for what we were observing in the post-1950 or maybe post-1945 period of time. And the reason for that is that in Polanyi's book, he argues for a set of interlocked changes in culture, in law, and the economy, using Britain primarily as his example, that took place in the late 18th and the early 19th century and embedded the market economy into culture and law. And he's arguing in the book that the market economy is not a natural human construct. It has to be created, and it was created through these interlocked changes in culture and law. And it seemed to me that the Great Acceleration also represents a collection of interlocked changes in various driving forces behind global scale environmental change that I'm sure we'll get into in a moment, and various indicators of global environmental change, such as the carbon concentration in the atmosphere or the nature of the climate system and so forth. So it's the interlockedness of and combination of a set of variables that seemed to me to recommend using a term paying homage to Karl Polanyi. And that's why I thought this was a useful term. And Will Steffen deserves a lot of credit for grabbing onto it and advancing it within the Earth system science community.
Indeed, he Will Steffen is associated with these great acceleration curves, which show that the great acceleration, very graphically, just things start to skyrocket in around mid-20th century.
Yeah, and he and his associates were coming to that conclusion before the Dahlem workshop, and some environmental historians, including myself, had come to that conclusion before the Dahlem workshop, but we hadn't crystallized this the way that I hope the great acceleration concept crystallizes it.
John McNeil, can you tell me, like, what impact human beings had back when they were nomadic hunter-gatherers, right? I mean, the modern human species is, maybe, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand years old, or 300,000 years. Numbers vary. Back then, how many human beings were there, like, I don't know, 200,000 years ago, and what impact did they have on the land around them?
So, in any review of human impact on the environment, one of the key developments is actually dates back to our hominin ancestors, and that is the harnessing of fire, which looks like it took place at least 700,000 years ago and maybe well before that. The reason that's important is because fire is a tremendously efficient tool for the transformation of landscapes. Landscape burning, vegetation burning, until comparatively recently, was the only efficient tool that humans had for transforming their environments. And in the last 300,000 years, our species, having inherited this capability, has used it more widely. And in the era prior to about 12,000 years ago, when, as far as we can tell, there was no such thing as agriculture, our ancestors did change the face of the earth, mainly through burning vegetation. But there's one other thing that is of fundamental importance that happened before agriculture, and that is the late Pleistocene extinctions. And while we don't know for sure that humans bear responsibility for this, the weight of the evidence suggests that humans do share at least some of the responsibility. So what I'm speaking of here is the extinction of large numbers of species, particularly of megafauna, in the Americas and Australia, and to a lesser extent, other parts of the world, at the end of the Pleistocene. So somewhere around 20,000 to 10,000 years ago.
What were these megafauna?
So there are all kinds. In the Americas, we had, you know, giant sloths, we had huge armadillos, we had bears bigger than anything that we've got now, horses, which went extinct and then were reintroduced into the Americas in the 16th century, dozens of genera, hundreds of species went extinct. In fairly short order in the matter of a few millennia. Maybe climate change is implicated. Maybe there could have been some spectacular epizootics for which there's zero evidence, but theoretically it's possible. But human overhunting, the overkill hypothesis, is probably at least substantially responsible for this. So assuming that is correct, and I'm among those who think it probably is, then we have a huge environmental impact that is at least partly owing to human activity. And it's not just the elimination of hundreds of species. These species, many of them were herbivores, grass-eating animals, that helped to regulate the balance between forests and grasslands around the world, the way that, for example, in East Africa, elephants regulate the balance between forests or savanna and forest, or the way that until the 1880s in North America, bison helped to regulate the balance between forests and grassland. We had lots of species doing this 12, 15,000 years ago, and in the Americas and Australia, most of them went extinct. So the vegetation of the planet was indirectly affected by whatever it was that caused the late Pleistocene extinctions. And there is an argument that precisely because of these vegetation changes, which would probably add up to less grassland and more forest, that the distribution of carbon between vegetation, atmosphere, and ocean was also affected, and therefore possibly some climatic implications to the late Pleistocene extinctions. This is by no means secure in science, but it's an interesting idea.
So how many human beings were running around, I don't know, 15 to 20,000 years ago? How many of us were there?
Very few by modern standards, probably fewer than live in the Toronto metropolitan area at the moment. So at most, just a few million. And when I say, I mean, that means fewer than 10 million. And if you are thinking about 50,000 years ago, it's probably fewer than 1 million. The evidence is extremely spotty, however, for Pleistocene population numbers.
So human beings, I mean, they were certainly a bloody, brutal, destructive species, but there weren't a lot of them. So how much change? Clearly, they altered their environments locally and regionally, but globally?
Yeah, so one thing to bear in mind here is that until 100,000 years ago, and maybe a little bit later than that, human beings existed in Africa and only in Africa. And there, their numbers were held in check, partly probably by pathogens, partly by the limitations of their own technologies. When they began the exodus from Africa, whether that was 100,000 years ago or 70,000 years ago, they entered into new environments in which none of the existing species had any prior exposure to and experience with smart, cooperative, tool-wielding, weapon-using creatures, so that these other species were comparatively naive and more easily hunted and therefore overhunted. So it's less in Africa, our homeland, than in the far-flung regions of the world, such as the Americas and Australia, that Pleistocene humans had their biggest impacts, both with fire and with hunting. So if you add all that up, even though human numbers were small, a few million at most, there's still an argument that I think is sound to say that they had substantial impacts on environments, and through extinctions, they had durable impacts on environments. None of that, however, in my understanding, means that the Anthropocene began 12,000 or 15,000 years ago. The reason for that, in my view, is that I conceive of the Anthropocene in a more constricted way, perhaps because I've been influenced by the Earth system science community, and think that only when human beings began fundamentally altering the governing biogeophysical cycles of the Earth should we say that the Anthropocene has begun. So you can have environmental impact without it being the Anthropocene. And you do.
So you can have environmental impacts without actually changing the way Earth functions, without pushing Earth into a totally new state.
Yeah, and that has happened on some scale for 300,000 years. It happened on a greater scale after the development and spread of agriculture. But in the middle of the 20th century, for the first time, as far as the available evidence tells us, the envelope of variability of the Holocene was exceeded in terms of the parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, in terms of ocean acidity, and a host of other variables. So all these things were always in flux, and humans had had some modest impact on that flux, but not until the middle of the 20th century do they push several of these variables outside the, shall we say, normal range of variability within the Holocene being the last 11,700 years. So that's the argument for seeing the middle of the 20th century as the birthday for the Anthropocene. It's pretty straightforward, because the Industrial Revolution, first in Britain, soon thereafter in Western Europe and Eastern North America, eventually many, many parts of the world, is the inauguration of a fossil fuel regime, initially based on coal, eventually based on coal, oil, and natural gas. And the true beginnings of this are in the very late 18th century in Britain. And so that is a taproot of the Anthropocene, if you take the view, as I do, that the fossil fuel energy regime is at the core of the Anthropocene. But at the same time, it's important to understand that for the first 100 years of industrialization, the impact of coal burning, all those steam engines, all those railroads and factories and textile mills, the impact of all of their carbon releases into the atmosphere was still pretty small.
This is like 1800, from 1800 to 1900, roughly.
Yeah, even to 1920. And it looks like greater carbon emissions came from deforestation and landscape burning around the world in the 19th century, a lot of which took place in North America, Canada included, a lot of which took place in Russia, some of it in other parts of the world. So industrialization is important. It's at the core of the Anthropocene, but in a quantitative sense, industrialization doesn't contribute all that much to the alteration of the carbon cycle, or even the sulfur cycle and the water cycle until the 20th century, and does so in a much more pronounced fashion after 1945 or 1950 than it did previously. So I like to think of the Industrial Revolution and industrialization in the 19th century generally as a taproot of the Anthropocene, but not the beginning of the Anthropocene, which, as you now know, I conceive of as taking place only in the middle of the 20th century. Even if the geology community formally adopts an Anthropocene with a base layer in 1950 or thereabouts, people in anthropology, literature, philosophy are going to continue to use the word Anthropocene and deploy the concept Anthropocene as fits their purposes. And they're not necessarily going to kowtow to the stratigraphers.
John McNeil is a professor of environmental history at Georgetown University. Among his writings, a book called Something Under the Sun, An Environmental History of the 20th Century World. We'll post our complete conversation with John McNeil at greenplanetmonitor.net, together with readings about the Anthropocene and the Great Acceleration. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Shout out to CFMU and CKMS listeners in Hamilton and Waterloo, Ontario, and CKUW fans in Winnipeg. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
Radio Rewind.